Before we start today's episode, a few scheduling notes. If you hear this on the date of its release, my newborn son should be 3 days old. So happy belated birthday, kid. It's also a few weeks before Thanksgiving, and the perfect time for Ann Arbor Stories to take a little break. We'll return with a holiday-themed episode on December 22nd, then get back to our regular cadence of new episodes every other Thursday, beginning January 5th, 2017. We really appreciate all the kind words we received about the podcast from friends, family, and people we're happy to have met. If you haven't already, please rate us on iTunes to help us reach even more people who want to hear weird stories about Ann Arbor, or pester your friends into listening. That's what we do. Now, right after one of the most contentious election seasons in the history of the United States, let's talk about presidents. Yay! This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Redd. George Washington never slept here. Neither did Abraham Lincoln, or Andrew Jackson, or George W. Bush. Of the 43 men who have served as presidents of the United States since 2016, we are confident 17 commanders-in-chief have set foot in the Ann Arbor area. 18, if you count, young Army officer Ulysses S. Grant. He was stationed in Detroit, living with his wife from 1849 to 1850, and you have to imagine they made the trip to Ann Arbor to check out the town that stole the University of Michigan, right? So 18 presidents, it's settled, we're counting Grant, have visited, though not necessarily during their presidencies. Some came before, some came after. That's not a bad percentage, considering Ann Arbor didn't become a town until the nation's fourth president was in power, and Michigan wouldn't join the Union until the end of Andrew Jackson's term, the seventh president of the United States. These stories don't take into account the 2016 U.S. presidential election, which you know the result of, but we don't. If Donald Trump wins, we stay at 18 for now. If Hillary Clinton wins, then that number climbs to 19, and we have another story to tell. But let's talk about the 43 we do know about. Some presidents who never set foot in Ann Arbor still have interesting ties to the city. The sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams, signed the official deed to the land that would be called Ann Arbor on March 7, 1825. He never set foot in town, but we thank him for his signature. William Henry Harrison was the ninth president of the United States and served a single month, dying of natural causes shortly after his inauguration. That's not much time to travel to Little Ann Arbor, but long enough to be tied in a macabre way to our fair town. In 1878, long after William Henry Harrison had passed, his son died in North Bend, Ohio, about 250 miles south of Ann Arbor. A week later, one of the Harrison family's close family friends also passed away. Harrison's son and the family friend were scheduled to be buried close to one another in the local cemetery. While arrangements were made for a fancier funeral for the ex-president's son, the family friend was buried. The day before John Scott Harrison's funeral, cemetery workers discovered the family friend's grave dug up, the body missing. This was the late 1800s, and medical schools and hospitals around the country were in dire need of cadavers to practice on. Bodies obtained through legal means, like donation, were in short supply. A lucrative black market established itself. Grave robbings in big cities and college towns were a big problem, with medical schools and hospitals secretly paying up to $25 per corpse, close to $1,000 today. Ohio authorities followed a tip that led them to the Medical College of Ohio in Cincinnati. While investigating, one of the officers noticed a suspicious trap door. When they opened it, they saw a body tied by the ankles swaying down the hole. When they pulled it up, they discovered it wasn't the family friend they were looking for. It was ex-president's son, John Scott Harrison. Police shook down the medical college, unearthing a cadaver smuggling network involving a number of schools in the area. Bodies were being shipped throughout the Midwest in barrels marked pickles, some addressed to Quimby and Company in Ann Arbor. Authorities traveled to Ann Arbor, followed the pickle connection, where they eventually found the body they were looking for. The closest Abraham Lincoln got to Ann Arbor was Kalamazoo, campaigning on behalf of presidential candidate John Charles Fremont. But the Ann Arbor area boasts one of many schools in the country named for the nation's 16th president. The first of the Lincoln Consolidated Schools opened October 1924 at the corner of Whitaker and Willis Roads in Augusta Township. The schools were dedicated to giving country children the same advantages of a well-rounded public school education that city youngsters had. A fire nearly destroyed the building in 1925, but it was rebuilt and newly dedicated on Lincoln's birthday in 1927. In May 1938, a 12-foot-tall, 9-ton limestone statue of Lincoln was added to the grounds, paid for by the Federal Depression-era Works Progress Administration Program. There, Honest Abe stood proudly, as progress built around him. Until progress progressed too much, and Lincoln started sinking. Roadwork and utility improvements messed with the ground beneath Lincoln's feet, and around 2015, things were getting dire. Funds were raised to build a new foundation for the statue and move it 100 yards to safety. A little extra was thrown in to restore the sculpture to its natural color. Abe never set foot in Ann Arbor, but his statue is now on solid ground. Ronald Reagan never set foot in Ann Arbor, but the then president did stop in Detroit to campaign for gubernatorial candidate William Lucas in 1986. The Washtenaw County College Jazz Orchestra was recruited to play for the luncheon's attendees, including the sitting president, and by all accounts, they were pretty great. Is it time to talk about murder? Let's talk about murder. We don't condone presidential assassinations. In fact, we here at Ann Arbor Stories are 100% against assassinations of any kind. But they've happened. President James Garfield's assassin spent a decent amount of time in Ann Arbor, which may have helped put him on the path to murder. As a young man, Charles Guiteau inherited $1,000 from his grandfather and used it to travel from Freeport, Illinois to Ann Arbor to attend the University of Michigan. Unfortunately, he wasn't prepared for U of M's rigorous academics and failed the entrance exam. He attended Ann Arbor High School and prepared to retake the exam, but ultimately gave up, moved to upstate New York, and joined a cult. They rejected him too, nicknaming him Charles Get Out. Poor Guiteau went on to fail at a bunch more things before setting his sights on assassination. With borrowed money, he bought a .44-caliber Webley British Bulldog revolver. Pretty serious sidearm, paying extra for the ivory grip because he wanted the pistol to look good in a museum someday. Guiteau stalked Garfield at the train station in Washington, D.C., where he shot the president twice from behind. Garfield died 11 weeks later. Guiteau was found guilty of murder, danced his way to the gallows, shook hands with the executioner, and recited a poem he had written for the occasion entitled, "I Am Going to the Lordy." His request to have an orchestra accompany his recitation was denied. A hood was placed over Guiteau's grinning face, the trapdoor sprung, and Guiteau hanged until he was dead. Martin Van Buren, 8th President of the United States, visited Ann Arbor at least once, July 11, 1842. He stayed for 4 hours, according to a letter Ann Arbor's John Geddes wrote his brother William, who lived in Pennsylvania. John Geddes was a town bigwig, running a sawmill on the Huron River while active in politics, serving as Justice of the Peace and as a state representative. He was important enough that when Van Buren came to town, just a year removed from the presidency, Geddes was among the folks invited to hobnob with him. John Geddes might also have been kind of a jerk. When describing the visit, John wrote to his brother, quote, "Van Buren is not an extraordinary man. I had 2 or 3 short but sharp debates on politics, and then started for home about 12:30. As I was walking home all alone, I thought, I must endeavor to avoid these needless and foolish debates, as they do no good and only aggravate instead of convince. For my part, I don't think much of Van Buren. I think his policy is injurious to the country and himself, no better than a leader of bandits and robbers. This is a warm day. Nothing more. Farewell." End quote. Maybe Geddes is the reason it took another 5 presidents in 31 years for another commander-in-chief to set foot in Ann Arbor. And when that president did, it was to visit his brother. Calvin Fillmore and his wife Miranda lived in a farmhouse on Dexter Ann Arbor Road. Calvin farmed and worked construction, helped build many of Dexter's first historic buildings, and he didn't love the work and wasn't a very good farmer. When his brother, Millard Fillmore, was chosen vice president to Zachary Taylor, Calvin wrote to his brother asking to be set up with a government job. Maybe customs collector, maybe a lighthouse keeper. Calvin asked that his son be made postmaster of Dexter. Millard was a supportive sibling. He had already taken on the mortgage of his brother's farmhouse, and he wasn't ignoring his brother's pleas, per se. It was politics. These requests weren't easy. Calvin kept writing, and Millard kept ignoring. Even when Millard assumed the presidency following Taylor's death, the letters went unanswered. Calvin continued to struggle on the land. Millard lost his bid for a second term. Calvin's declining health became the focal point of his correspondence. In 1873, he wrote that the cold weather was aggravating his diabetes and that he would like to move to a warmer climate. Ever the wet blanket, with little hope of moving out of Michigan, Calvin wrote, quote, "I shall have to live and die here after all," end quote. It's not clear who suggested the family reunion, but in July 1873, the five Van Buren siblings gathered together in Dexter. The New York Times wrote about it. Quote, "All were in good health, hale and hearty, and to all appearances bade fair to yet see many years of enjoyment and happiness," end quote. Millard gifted his brother $50, and Calvin sent him five copies of a photo taken at the event. The two continued to correspond, Millard helping finance renovations on the farmhouse. Millard died of a stroke the following year. In his will, the former president bequeathed his brother $500 and erased all his debts. Calvin lived another 5 years, dying from complications due to gangrene. Calvin, his wife, and his two sisters are buried in Forest Lawn Cemetery in Dexter. Presidents have visited the University of Michigan for quick speeches over the years. Benjamin Harrison spoke in Ann Arbor nearly a decade after his presidency. William Howard Taft spoke twice after his time in office. And Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt each lectured three times, none as sitting president. Not all speeches are equal. Four presidents have spoken at UM's commencement ceremonies, an honor to both the university and the men speaking. George Herbert Walker Bush spoke at U of M's 1991 spring commencement, followed by Bill Clinton, who spoke at the 2007 commencement, and President Barack Obama, who spoke at the 2010 spring commencement as the sitting commander-in-chief. Clinton also spoke at Eastern Michigan University's 2000 commencement, earning the rare Washtenaw County double dip. The most famous presidential commencement speaker was Lyndon Johnson, who stood in front of a crowd at the Big House in May of 1964, just 6 months after the assassination of JFK. The university originally invited JFK to speak at commencement, but that tragic day in Dallas ended that hope. Michigan chose to extend the invitation to the nation's new president, Lyndon Johnson, who graciously accepted. LBJ became the first sitting president to speak at a U of M commencement. Johnson didn't mail it in. He called for his top aides and his best speechwriter to join him for a little brainstorm skinny dip in the White House pool. He wanted to launch a Johnson program that would continue Kennedy's work on civil rights and Medicare, but do even more. The commencement speech was the kickoff of Johnson's election campaign. The Secret Service was on high alert. Sections of Michigan Stadium were blocked off behind the president, and the stadium swarmed with armed guards. Estimates put the crowd somewhere between 70,000 and 85,000, crammed into the open sections of Michigan Stadium to hear LBJ speak. Four helicopters landed nearby, and just before 10 a.m., LBJ was rushed into the stadium where he changed into his academic robes in the visitors' locker room. He walked down the tunnel and onto the field to the band playing Hail to the Chief. What would be known as LBJ's Great Society speech went very well. It was 20 minutes long. Johnson had to pause 29 times for applause. On the plane back to D.C., the president was euphoric. He'd eventually win the election, beating Barry Goldwater in the fifth largest landslide victory in U.S. presidential election history. The Big House bump. Y'all know Gerald Ford attended the University of Michigan, but it wasn't until he was out of office that he returned to town to visit the Wolverines during preseason football practice in 1977. 6 years later, in 1983, Ford was joined in Ann Arbor by former President Jimmy Carter, who sat beside him at the dedication of the Ford Library. Two notable presidential visits are attached to Willow Run. The first was a visit to the Willow Run bomber plant made by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1942, 1 month after its completion. Willow Run mass-produced the B-24 Liberator heavy bomber, which saw significant action in the Pacific. More than 8,500 B-24s were built at Willow Run, with one bomber built every hour during the peak of production. Willow Run Airfield passed to civilian control after the war and welcomed FDR's successor, Harry S. Truman, on two occasions. Then President Truman landed at Willow Run in the summer of 1951, stepping off his C-54 Skymaster transport plane, the first plane put into service for official presidential use. Fun fact, Truman was the last president to use the Skymaster as his official presidential plane, and the last president to fly in a plane that didn't have the official call sign of Air Force One. When Truman made the return visit in 1958, following his presidency, he walked down the steps of a Capital Airlines plane. He never set foot in Ann Arbor, instead making a quick trip to Detroit to meet Democratic leaders, then heading home. What story do you end with in a presidential marathon like this? Should we have saved the story about cadavers in pickle barrels, anchored with LBJ's Great Society speech, or hit you with Grover Cleveland, the most popular man in Ann Arbor? Don't believe us? Here you go. Ann Arbor yearned to get Cleveland to pay a visit way before he became president. Newspapers like the Ann Arbor Argus wrote, "There is no man in the United States who can draw a larger audience in Ann Arbor than Grover Cleveland." And this was before he even came here. When the man, the myth, and the legend finally accepted the invitation to deliver the annual Washington birthday address before the University of Michigan's Law Department, he was met at the train depot by 2,000 adoring U of M students. He'd been out of office 3 years, but on February 22, 1892, no one in Ann Arbor cared. The Ann Arbor Guard and Ypsilanti Light Infantry led a procession to University Hall, where Cleveland delivered the speech that would mark the launch of his successful national campaign to seek an unprecedented non-consecutive presidential term. He lost a re-election bid to Benjamin Harrison, but rallied to win the rematch in 1892 and serve another 4 years in the White House. The same year as Cleveland's speech and re-election, Ann Arborite Charles Hauser of West Liberty Street named his seventh son Grover Cleveland Hauser. Through the county treasurer, Hauser sent a letter to President Cleveland informing him of his namesake and asking him to act as a sponsor for the child. Cleveland wrote back, quote, "My dear sir, I have been informed by Mr. Gustav Brehm of the birth to your household of a seventh son, to whom you have given my name. I am also asked to act as a sponsor for the child. Supposing that in this ceremony nothing is required of me except my consent to act, I most cheerfully accede to the request. I hope that my namesake will live long in health and happiness, and that he may always be a comfort to his parents. Very truly yours, Grover Cleveland." End quote. Grover Cleveland, what a guy. We can't end on that. There's one more story to tell, and it ties three presidents together and offers a glimpse into the rivalry between Richard Nixon and JFK. Dwight Eisenhower never visited Ann Arbor, but during the 1952 presidential campaign, he sent his vice president, Richard Nixon, on the road to stump for him. Young Nixon was a decent-looking guy with a beautiful wife, Pat, and a promising political career ahead of him. He presented very well. Nixon rolled into the Ann Arbor train depot on Ike's whistle-stop tour of the Midwest and speechified from the back platform, an American flag blowing in the breeze next to him, and Pat sitting in a tasteful living room chair over his left shoulder. A nice-sized crowd came to hear Nixon speak, and, though he didn't stay long, Ann Arbor developed a little crush on Tricky Dick. Nixon was back at the train station on October 27, 1960, Pat again at his side, this time campaigning for his own presidency against John F. Kennedy. With the election just 10 days away and Ann Arbor in a full-blown crush, Ann Arborites made a huge deal of the visit. Around 3,000 of the 12,170 kids in the Ann Arbor public school system didn't show up for class that Thursday, including more than half of the 2,000 pupils at Ann Arbor High School. All told, 15,000 people packed the train depot, pushing in on the former vice president. Nixon toured Ann Arbor with his wife, welcomed at every turn by area luminaries. They shook hands with U of M head football coach Bump Elliott and his staff and were presented with a 100-foot scroll signed by U of M student supporters, a gift from the University of Michigan Youth for Nixon Committee. It was a memorable visit. A few days later, Nixon sent a letter of thanks to Ann Arbor Police Chief Roland Gainsley, writing, quote, "Mrs. Nixon and I shall long have the most happy memories of our visit to Ann Arbor last Thursday. We were deeply touched by the friendly welcome we received. We certainly appreciate this splendid cooperation and assistance provided us by the Ann Arbor Police. Sincerely, Richard Nixon." End quote. The visit overshadowed another candidate stop in Ann Arbor just 2 weeks prior. JFK flew into Ann Arbor around midnight on October 14, 1960, and rode with police escort to the Michigan Union on State Street, where he planned to spend the night. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, when he pulled up to the Union, they ran into a crowd of 10,000 students waiting for the candidate's arrival. JFK pushed through the crowd, climbed the large steps of the Union, and gave an impromptu speech. That speech, in the middle of the night, would first define the Peace Corps, resulting in 220,000 Peace Corps volunteers 1 year later. The next morning, Kennedy was escorted to the Ann Arbor train depot, where he spoke to a more modest crowd of around 5,000 from the rear of his 8-car campaign train. In less than 3 weeks, Kennedy would be president. The Ann Arbor bump. Boom. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumblepack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written, researched, and read by me, Rich Reddy, with recording and sound production by Brian Peters. Thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library and their archive staff, who continue to help us locate and research these stories. Please follow us on Twitter at Ann Arbor Stories, or drop us a line at annarborstories@gmail.com. We'd love to hear what you thought of this episode, and please, if you have ideas for an episode you'd like to hear about, don't be shy. Thanks for listening, and gosh bless the United States of America.